Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the NDAC Release on Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Good afternoon, friends. Thank you for joining part three of our webinar. This initiative, of course, is done with an objective that there has been a lot of development so far as the insolvency and bankruptcy law is concerned in India since its coming into force in 2016 in December. I think there is a lot of buzz around it. There are a lot of judgments. There is a lot of jurisprudence coming in. In fact, this is one law which is up for amendments and within less than 2 years. And yesterday we read the news that the government is bringing in the amendments through the ordinance route, which means that we will see the amendments getting effected very, very soon. That shows the importance and seriousness of this subject. So we have already done part one and part two of this series on April 10 and May 2 of this year. We covered the proposed amendment, which were part of the committee report. We have delved into some of the topics in detail on May 2 as well. So today, the agenda for the meeting today is that we want to deal with three specific cases more in detail to bring in the factual scenario in a way to marry the facts and law and how they have evolved based on the interpretation and the practical realities. For that, I have been joined by my colleagues. I have Karan and Simon in our Bombay office. I also have Ashish and Kamran in our Delhi office, and also Arjun in our Bombay office. We all would be, looking at some of these judgments in great detail, and also thereafter discuss the issues which are part of these judgments. So the way we have tried to bifurcate the judgments, the first one Ashish will deal is in respect to the SR matter, particularly from the aspects of the eligibility of bidders. Arjun will then follow up with Electrosteel, taking forward that topic. And then Kamran will deal with Bhushan Steel in detail. Again, there were interesting issues which came up as part of Bhushan Steel. So as part of these three judgments, we'll try and deal as many issues as we can. And then, of course, continue in the next webinar, which we will shortly hold in next couple of weeks, which we will announce as well immediately after the webinar is over. So with that introduction, I'll hand it over to Ashish Kabra, who is a senior member and leads this insolvency and bankruptcy law practice sitting out of our Delhi office. And he will give some thoughts and his views on the SR matter. And then followed up by Arjun and Kamran. So over to Ashish.
Thank you, Vyapak. Thank you for setting the stage. And good evening, good afternoon to all our participants here on the call. Now, the SR case is really interesting because the bidders in SRs are people with deep pockets. The amount involved are huge. So each bidder has pulled out all stops to make the other ineligible, while at the same time making efforts to make itself eligible on grounds of eligibility being in, or the grounds of ineligibility being the same. So the case throws up various interesting issues which are there, and the bidders being primarily two, which is NewMetal, and the other being the ArcelorMittal Group. Now, first sort of diving into the facts of the case and sort of explaining the ineligibility, and I'll probably divide my exercise or explanation of the case in two. One, the bid of NewMetal, and two, the bid of ArcelorMittal. So starting with the bid of NewMetal, so in NewMetal, it was a company, NewMetal, which was bidding, and it consisted of primarily four shareholders, namely Aurora Holdings, Crinium, which was a VTB Group subsidiary, Indo International Trading, which was essentially a steel and commodities trader based out of UAE, and lastly TPE, which was an engineering consultant company providing engineering solutions in the sector. So these four shareholders combined to form an entity called NewMetal and had bid for the and had bid in place and put the input in their resolution plan. Now, the grounds for why their bid was seen as ineligible was particularly drawing out of one of these four shareholders, which is Aurora Holdings. Now, Aurora was ultimately beneficially owned by Revanth Ruia, and this holding was through a series of holding companies and a trust. Now, because of this holding of a shareholder being held by Revanth Ruia, they looked at Revanth Ruia and they found that Revanth Ruia's father, who they thought was a person acting in concert with Revanth Ruia, had held certain accounts which were classified as an NPA. For namely, Revanth Ruia himself was, Ravi Ruia himself was the promoter of SR Steel. And therefore, SR Steel had been classified as an NPA for over a year. And hence, Ravi Ruia was ineligible on account of Section 29AC to participate in the bidding process. And Ravi Ruia, being Revanth Ruia's father, qualified as a person acting in concert, and ultimately this ineligibility reaching down to NewMetal and sort of disqualifying their bid. And the other ground was, again going back to Ravi Ruia, was that Ravi Ruia executed a guarantee in favor of SBI for this very loan which SR had taken. And because SR was, because the insolvency proceedings against the SR had been admitted and initiated, under Section 29AH, the disqualification which is prescribed therein got attracted. So on these two grounds, it was seen that NewMetal's bid is ineligible. Now, NewMetal's response was primarily on five points. First, it said that, look, Aurora is not a promoter or in control of NewMetal. Aurora's shareholding was limited to 25%, and it did not have any rights to appoint any director or reserve matter rights or any other such arrangements which it could qualify as somebody being in control or being in management of the company. So on that basis, they said that, look, we are not in controlling or promoting or managing NewMetal. Second, they said was that Revanth Ruia does not own Aurora, it's the Aurora company itself. Their rationale for this was that in the structure, which ultimately evolved in the holding through a trust, Revanth Ruia was basically the Revanth Ruia's holding or had beneficiary interest in a trust which was in the nature of a discretionary trust. Now, discretionary trust is one where the entitlement of the beneficiary is not decided beforehand. It is something which is decided subsequently by the trustee based on certain arrangements or certain mechanisms provided in the trust deed. So given the nature of the trust through which Revanth Ruia was holding Aurora, the company, it was said that it cannot be said to be exercising control or having any management rights. Third, they said, even though Ravi Ruia may have been Revanth Ruia's father and may be deemed to be a person acting in concert, it is a rebuttable presumption. And this is something going back to the Takeover Code, because in the Takeover Code, you may qualify, or there are certain people who are considered as persons acting in concert, But this is something which may be rebutted. So this was their third contention. Fourth, they said, or they were put forth a proposal that, look, if Aurora's holding in New Metal leads to its ineligibility in making a bid, they would rather sell that stake and have Aurora move out of this arrangement in New Metal, and only the three other shareholders would remain. So in this way, they were also trying to propose and get rid of the ineligibility. And lastly, it was a fairly basic assertion that, look, Revan is not the promoter or in management or in control of the resolution applicant directly, that is New Metal. Now, the resolution professional went and obtained opinions from different law, leading law firms and leading senior counsels in the country, and based their opinion, put forth and made certain observations and put it before the Committee of Creditors. And the Committee of Creditors simply went by what the resolution professional had suggested to them. Now, the resolution professional took a view that these that the bid of New Metal will be hit by Section 29A, and the rationale resolution professional gives is very interesting. Resolution professional says that New Metal was an entity incorporated 7 days before the bid was made. And it was an entity incorporated 7 days before the bid was made, and the way it was functioning was that it was relying upon the shareholders to satisfy its own financial and other eligibility requirements under the bidding process. So it was viewed as more of a consortium of partners coming in as opposed to a company with four shareholders, which led to the resolution professional looking at the four shareholders and their persons and their connected persons and persons acting in concert with them as opposed to New Metal itself. Now, this is fairly interesting, and on this basis, the resolution professional went ahead and looked at Revan Ruia and eventually moved on to Ravi Ruia. Now, this issue came up before the court, and the NCLT in this case said that, look, various legal luminaries have given their legal opinions and come up to different conclusions. Now, if there are different positions in law which can be taken on this fact situation, I would only interfere if the view resolution professional takes is something which is completely illegal or arbitrary. And in the given facts, they were of the opinion that what the resolution professional was doing was not so, and therefore they did not come in and interfere with the view taken up by the resolution professional and consequently the Committee of Creditors. Now, this is the first leg of it, which is New Metal. Coming to the second leg, which is Arsenal Mittal. Now, in case of Arsenal Mittal's bid, there were two aspects again. First was KSS Patrol. Now, this was a company which was again a non-performing asset, classified as a non-performing asset for over a year. And this was eventually held by or controlled by Ellen Mittal, who is the founder chairman of the Mittal Group. Now, they found that Ellen Mittal was able to exercise negative control over this entity, KSS Patrol, which was again an NPA. And therefore, because of this aspect, the bidding entity also being under the control of Ellen Mittal, who would then get qualified as a connected person of the bidder, and then consequently a connected person who is ineligible under Section 29AC. Second was Uttam Galwa. Now, this is the one which has been more in news. Now, in case of Uttam Galwa, again, one of the entities which was eventually holding shares in the resolution applicant through a series of holding companies and was also the promoter of Uttam Galwa, which was basically Arsenal Mittal Netherlands being classified as a promoter of Uttam Galwa. Now, Uttam Galwa is also a non-performing asset for over a year and therefore disqualified. But the issue here was that the shares of Uttam Galwa had been sold off by Arsenal Mittal. And therefore, whether by sale can one divest, or whether by divestment can one get rid of the ineligibility which gets attracted under Section 29AC was the issue which was faced by the NCLT. Now, NCLT, interestingly, in this regard, held that, given the fact that what is stated in Section 29AC proviso, which says that person shall be eligible to submit a resolution plan if such person makes the payment of all overdue amounts with interest thereon and charges relating to non-performing asset and accounts before submission of resolution plan. So therefore, what is provided here that the ineligibility under Section 29AC would no longer be attractive if you have paid off all the debts due. Thereafter, the NCLT looked at Section 34, subsection 4, the second proviso, which again says, provided further, that resolution applicant referred to in the first proviso is ineligible under Section 29AC, shall be allowed by the committee of creditors such period but not exceeding 30 days to make payment of overdue amounts in accordance with the proviso of Clause C of 29A. Viewing these two provisos, the NCLT was of the view that, look, the intent behind the intent of the code is that an ineligibility attracted under Section 29AC can only be resolved by paying off the dues and not by divestment of the stake. So this is something fairly interesting which has come up, and an observation which has come up through these proceedings. Second issue which was here was, from what date do you consider on what date would you apply or look at the bidder to consider the applicability of Section 29AC? That is, will you look at the date the bid is submitted and consider as on that date whether the applicant is would be ineligible, or whether will you take some other date to see whether the applicant would be ineligible? In the present case, the NCLT goes on to hold, and this it does in light of the express language of Section 29AC, that it will be the date on which the corporate insolvency process commenced to see whether the ineligibility under Section 29AC is attracted or not. And just to sort of elaborate on this, I'll read out what 29AC says. It provides, a person shall not be eligible to submit a resolution plan if such person has an account or an account of a corporate debtor under the management or control of such person, of whom such person is a promoter classified as a non-performing asset in accordance with the RBI guidelines, and at least 1 year has elapsed from the date of such classification, that is the date on which the account has been classified as a non-performing asset. So 1 year has elapsed from the date when the account gets classified as a non-performing asset till the date of commencement of the corporate insolvency resolution process of the corporate debtor. So looking at this language given in 29AC, the NCLT has come to the conclusion that the ineligibility would be seen from the, as given 29AC, from on the date on which the corporate insolvency process commenced. And if on that date 1 year had elapsed from the date the applicant or any person connected with the applicant holding an account being classified as a non-performing asset. Now,
yep. So Ashish, I think two very critical questions or rather observations come forward on this aspect, right? One on New Metal, I think the interesting bit is that ultimately, the NCLT was not keen to say what is right and what is wrong. They were possibly saying that, look, so long as there are two views possible, if RPA has taken a reasonable view, then we should just go with that view rather than get into what should be the ideal view. And I think in terms of the issue related to ArcelorMittal, I think the point is that can a person try and participate in a bidding process, and maybe at the time when a particular corporate is admitted under the insolvency, they may or may not be eligible, but if they are interested in bidding, can they thereafter take steps to ensure that they become as part of eligible bidder? And by not allowing that steps to be taken, are you trying to shrink the pool of bidders, even for some technical reason if somebody is not able to, you know, bid. So on these two points, maybe let me bring in Karan and Simon, or if Karan has any broad, you know, thoughts whether is this the right approach, or should NCLT clarify the aspects a little more to avoid this kind of a situation where RPs are taking, you know, different views based on legal opinions or otherwise, or this is something which should be left open for further discussions depending upon the facts of each case.
Sure. No, Vyapak, I think you bring in a very relevant point. This probably goes into the beginning and something we brought up in our first session, where we actually said that should there have been a 29A ordinance at all and thereafter included in the law. If the best bidder in the eyes of the COC is a particular person who is getting caught by these 29A notifications and the various forms you've seen of it, and the Committee of Creditors believes, and then there's also the NCLT sitting there to look at the process being fair, why should have these restrictions anyway been there? So going to the very root of it, I do feel slightly differently as some of these judgments have brought out. That said, it also brings another nuance point that maybe we can talk about today or later, is in what form are we really seeing these judgments? And while it's good, we are moving towards a resolution and process and trying to resolve all the NPAs that we have, have we really taken a step back from being a reasoned judicial process and some of these being reactionary? Is the other question it's thrown out. So again, I mean, to reiterate, I would say no. The eligibility criteria need to be looked at, if anything, substantively and not merely objectively, and maybe should not even be there beyond a certain point. I mean, you know, there are more that we'll talk about, and I know Arjun will bring up some as far as electrosteel is concerned and the ineligibility as far as criminal offenses are concerned. We'll talk a little more about them, but
sure.
I think that's the important flavor that we
also
need to consider.
Also, in terms of this whole deemed person in acting in concert. So I think two things happen in new metals so far as what went against them, right? Or what was alleged against them. One, they looked through the entity and went into the shareholders who were holding the shares in the entity. So the question is how far you can do that. They came with one tier structure. What if some people would have come into a two or three tier structure? How far people would have gone to decide where they stop this whole aspect of defining person in acting in concert for the purpose of Aurora entity. And two, as part of the person acting in concert as a topic, one is to look at it from a takeover code perspective, which has a very different objective. That is to stop certain things unless an exit is given to the rest of the shareholders and things like that, or put certain onus on people who come together. Other is to allow little flexibility of people coming and bidding. So to put strict thresholds for takeover code may be a very different objective and you may be able to justify it, but to put even more stringent of criteria or thresholds for deemed acting in concert. Is that the correct approach? And maybe, Simon, if you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. So Vyapak, you're right. In fact, you know, we have a plethora of regulators, each regulating maybe a different arena, but somehow the definitions seem to be aligned or, you know, imported from one regulation to another. But it may not necessarily make sense in one regulation as it does in another. We've seen that in certain aspects of the Competition Act, especially where, you know, the matter of control has always been debated. And now we come about with, you know, persons acting in concert, connected person, deemed acting in concert, and so on and so forth. And therefore, yes, there is a concern, there could be a concern, in terms of, you know, whether even the principles of the takeover code, including, you know, rebuttable presumptions, are looked at carefully and have to be tested vis-a-vis who would be a connected person and who would be a deemed connected person. So if you are, even if you are importing a certain definition, it has to be imported in its entirety and can't be imported just in isolation from the interpretation of how it should be looked at. And I think coming to the point of the entire bankruptcy code, the entire aspect was maximization of value. At the end of the day, we have a COC that is supposed to look at it's supposed to take into consideration value, financial, as well as the value that it will bring to the company on a going forward basis, and extend that to determining or having the determining who should be the successful bidder. So in that context, perhaps some of these criteria, which are really strict criteria, that do not, may or may not really contribute to the end goal, should be viewed at a little bit more objectively, as opposed to being so so straight and fastened.
Sure. So I think as Karan and Simon were mentioning about the whole issue of how far you go by making people ineligible, in sense how far you go to shrink the pool in terms of eligible bidders, I think one good action or suggestion which has been accepted, at least for the MSMEs, which we'll see in the ordinances, at least looks like that there have been relaxations prescribed in the new amendment, at least for those entities, and we'll see how it pans out. But at least the steps are already taken to see that this pool doesn't get too small, that the objective is lost. So we'll come back to Ashish in a bit on the aspects around the ineligibility a bit, but continuing what Karan and Simon mentioned about it, and looking at the stringent norms of ineligibility, I think we also have another example of Electrosteel, where things from a factual perspective were a little different, and Arjun will throw some light on it, and also then we'll connect the aspects as to where this whole aspect of ineligibility is going. Are we going too far? Are we meeting the objectives, or do we require some course correction on this aspect?
Thank you, Vyapak. We are going to deal with a different aspect of disqualification under Section 29A in respect of Electrosteel. One of the grounds or criteria which would deem a person ineligible to participate in insolvency proceedings as a resolution applicant is if the applicant is convicted for an offense punishable with imprisonment of 2 years or more. So considering that this criteria was slightly wide and not so specific in nature, there was a lot of debate around what would be the impact of this kind of a wide disqualification criteria for two prospective resolution applicants. And considering that there was a fair amount of debate and discourse on this, and there was a lot of chatter on different media portals as well, the Law Commission report, which has provided a lot of different suggestions with respect to possible amendments to the Bankruptcy Code, has come up with a few suggestions. I'll just take you through those. There are basically three suggestions which the Commission has recommended. One is to determine the scope of this disqualification, because the disqualification applies to a prospective resolution applicant, a joint applicant along with that applicant, and all connected persons to them. Now, the definition of connected person also includes related parties to the applicant and the joint applicants. So therefore, there are basically three layers of entities which will get hit by such disqualification criteria. So the Commission has recommended that the scope of the term connected person, when being used for the interpretation of this particular disqualification, which is conviction for a punishable offense, this should be restricted. This should exclude related parties of the resolution applicant and the joint applicants. The second was with respect to the crime, the conviction for an offense punishable. Now, they haven't given a category for these offenses, and therefore they have said that we should try and water down the scope of this eligibility criteria, and they have taken inspiration from other acts like Schedule 5 of the Companies Act, which provides a similar list of offenses which will deem a director to be ineligible to hold the position of a director. And they have said that such a schedule may be formulated for the IBC as well, and which can be amended or modified by the IBBI or the central government during the course of time. Further, they have also taken inspiration from the Representation of People Act, and they have said that the period of disqualification should also be restricted to something like 6 years from the date of release of from imprisonment for such a person. The last suggestion was with respect to a stay which has been granted on such an order of imprisonment. If there is a stay which is ordered on an order of imprisonment, then the person should cease to be disqualified under the IBC. Now, if we come to the specific case of Electrosteel, let me just first take you through the facts over here. Electrosteel was under the insolvency resolution process, where there were multiple bidders who had shown interest in the resolution process, including Renesas Steel, Tata Steel, as well as Vedanta Limited. Vedanta Limited was a subsidiary of Vedanta Resources PLC. Vedanta Resources PLC also had another subsidiary by the name of Konkola Copper Mines, which had operations in Namibia. Konkola Copper Mines was convicted under one of the environment protection laws in Namibia, where it faced a conviction for payment of 100,000 Namibian currency, in default of which it would have to undergo imprisonment for a period of 3 years. So this point of Konkola Copper Mines facing an order of imprisonment was brought before the NCLT by Renesas Steel, and they said that this effectively deemed the bid of Vedanta Limited to be ineligible under the IBC. The NCLT said that considering that Konkola Copper Mines and Vedanta Limited were both subsidiaries of the same parent company, they would fall within the definition of connected persons under the relevant section of under 29A. And thereafter, it went into the definition of the word person, because 29A starts with any person who falls under any of the below mentioned disqualification criteria will not be able to participate. So the definition of person under IBC mentions that it can be a company or an individual. And that's why the NCLT said that if a company, its directors or its officers face an order of imprisonment, then it will fall within the scope of this disqualification criteria. Thereafter, the NCLT went into the question of what is the degree of this order, whether the degree was serious enough for Vedant to stand disqualified. So over here, the NCLT actually made reference to a Supreme Court judgment of Standard Chartered versus Directorate of Enforcement, which had distinguished between an offense where there could be an imprisonment or fine, and an offense for which there would be an imprisonment and fine. In the present scenario, because the order said that there would be a fine of 100,000 Namibian currency, in default of which there would be imprisonment, therefore it fell into the first category of imprisonment or fine, which was deemed to be less serious in nature by the Supreme Court. And that is why the NCLT said that because it is not so serious, and because it has been specifically stated that there lies a more serious offense, which would be imprisonment and fine, therefore Vedant would not fall within the scope of the disqualification. We can say that NCLT was trying to have a constructive interpretation of the statute in the absence of any further guidelines. but there still remains quite a bit of ambiguity with respect to such a wide disqualification criteria. Some things like, what would be the look back period for this kind of a conviction? How back do you go to see whether there are convictions for either the company or its directors or its officers? Or what if there is a conviction of one of the officers post the insolvency commencement date? Or what if there is a conviction for one of the directors which resulted in the director being removed from the board by the company itself? Does this mean that the company and its ability to manage itself also gets directly affected by that kind of a conviction? We'll have to wait and see whether the impending amendments to the code gives us a little more clarity on this aspect as well, or whether we'll have further judgments of the NCLT and the NCLT, which gives us a better interpretation with respect to the scope, applicability, and the operational aspect of this section.
Sure. So I think we have seen three or four different, reasons vis-a-vis the eligibility or the ineligibility. And of course, the fight is all between the bidders itself, because one would want to make sure that the competition is out. And therefore, most of these cases are coming out of the allegations and counter allegations inter say the bidders. Sometimes there is a role by the RP or the COC, but I think most of them it is something which stems out of the issues which are brought in by the different bidders. So one very interesting issue comes up in this regard, and maybe again Karan or Simon, what will be the role of RP and COC to look into this aspect? Because if you really see the kind of reasons, let's say in Vedanta, where one of the subsidiary in one of the countries may have been fined, how would RP or COC would even know? And whether RP and COC have a overarching obligation to do diligence or get some services to make sure they don't end up with an ineligible bidder, or this is something which is the onus of the bidder, or if it doesn't come out in public domain, then it's fine. So how would you look at it from that perspective? Is it something very serious, or is it something which, if it doesn't come out in public domain, then it's fine?
So I think, Vyapak, to resolve exactly this problem, the amendments of the report suggests that self-declarations be given to the RP by applicants. And I think even today, it is for the RP to maybe set out a process basis which certain criteria need to be looked at, but over and above the process and what's perhaps available in the public domain, it'll be difficult for the RP to clear this by itself. So I think it will definitely result in undertakings, etc., having to be given by resolution applicants, as well as the RP perhaps doing some reasonable search just to see whether these, on the face of it, there merits any discrepancy. But largely it would be on the applicant. But I think it's important to also sort of commend this this NCLT order, because the words used in 29A could be read a little very differently, because it says today convicted of an offence punishable with imprisonment of 2 years or more. So the words punishable could also be looked at in the future. So even if you are technically, just fined and your offence is such that it is punishable with imprisonment of 2 years, whether you are disqualified. But it looks like the NCLT has read this down to mean that if you are fined and fine or imprisonment, that means technically speaking, you could be out of the.
Sure. Also, there is another nuance to it. There are certain offenses where you are imprisoned if you don't pay the fine, and there are certain offenses where you can be fined and or imprisoned, both. Question is it non-serious only imprisonment is when you don't pay the fine, or it is insignificant only when you have given fine in spite of conviction and not given the imprisonment. So I think we'll obviously see many more such challenges to bidders as it goes. So maybe Karan, maybe one last comment from you on this, particularly on this aspect. But more importantly, I also want to know that considering the way the NCLT, I would, if I may use the word, treated the resolution professional on getting services from outside agents or outside service providers, or gave some indications as to what are the obligations of the resolution professional as to what he should do or not do. Considering that, is this something which resolution professional would look at it upfront in terms of hiring an agency to look into these issues, or is it his obligation, or this is something which is non-issue in terms of resolution professional, so long as there are no disclosures to that effect?
Sure. So I think I'll quickly react to both. I think one, as Simone rightly said, yes, the NCLT has really looked at it in the substance of this, with the way the law lied and not into a fine print. That said, I think an important point that, again, I'd like to make, and this is going back to the points I have been making earlier as well, do we really need a provision like this? And also, while the law attempted to say, okay, it's an offense that involves a punishable or a punishment up to or at least of 2 years of imprisonment, it doesn't quantify what or quantitatively look at what this dispute really should be. Is it a dispute of moral turpitude? Is it a dispute that he was involved in which really affects his ability to run a business? Also, we're not even talking about it's about who submits a plan. It's not about who is going to run the company tomorrow. As Arjun rightly brought out, there is a restriction on who can be directors or not be directors of a company. We've legislated that. Who can be officers that SEBI, etc. recognizes, or for a listed company can be people holding official posts, is also legislated. We're now saying somebody who has been convicted for something, which could be as simple as a traffic offense, which is unrelated, but involves a punishment arguably of 2 years or excess, or something, of course, very more serious or involving a moral turpitude, you're bringing that to the forefront and saying you're making the person ineligible to submit a plan. That's it, Vyapak, without taking too much time. Coming to your second question, what's the onus on the RP? I think it's fairly clear, and Simone put it very succinctly, the RP can't do beyond what is obvious or apparent in public domain. Should they appoint a third-party agency? Well, frankly, not. There shouldn't be a need or a requirement to appoint. If facts come up, like in this case, someone challenged the eligibility and they believe this is something that should be looked into, yes. In fact, if you look at the Binani order, that's another case where there's a lot of commentary given by the NCLT on whether a third-party professional can be appointed on a different point, but whether the RP can appoint a third-party professional. Can they actually have other third parties opining on it or not? And frankly, if the RP owns and owns the process, why not? You want cases to be resolved. I mean, our NPA numbers are worse than where they've ever been. These are first 12 cases. The next 40 are flowing in, and some of them already out there. There is no way that person or the RP can do it on its own in due time without not appointing due professionals outside. So
sure.
I think, Vyapak, in the spirit of resolution, they must have this ability and take the judicious call on their own.
Sure. So I think definitely...
Vyapak, on Karan's point, because
yeah,
this is interesting as to what and to what extent RPs go, at least in the SR Steel case, because of entities such as Aster Mittal and the other being New Metal, which is again consortium of leading banks such as VTB and all, were involved, they actually liaised with the resolution applicants and found out more than 2,000 connected entities. And they actually floated an RFP to the Big Four and others and appointed one person specifically to run through more than 2,000 entities and to verify which one of them are the NPA or not NPA, and reached out across multiple jurisdictions. So we don't know whether legally the resolution professional is bound to take such steps, but in certain cases, given the sensitivities, they seem to be taking them. So it seems there's some problem at the other end in Bombay. But I think continuing on with the discussion, and I think the next point that we were moving on to, and after finishing the cases of Electro Steel and ESSA, was the Bhushan Steel case. And probably that is something which our colleague here, Kamran, is going to deal with. So Kamran, could you now move forward with the Bhushan Steel and help us understand what were the various points which were involved in that particular case?
Sure. Thanks, Ashish. Let me first briefly touch upon the facts of this case and what was upheld by the tribunal. And maybe then we can call out some key insights and jurisprudence that and the issues that have emerged from the order. So very briefly put, the resolution professional in this case followed a two-stage process. The first stage was an eliminator round of sorts, where prospective resolution applicants were invited to prove their eligibility. Those resolution applicants who had who established their eligibility were then invited to submit their resolution plan in the second round. So coming back to the first stage, in September 2017, the resolution professional issued a public notice and invited expression of interest from potential resolution applicants. It also required the resolution applicants to submit documents which will establish their eligibility to submit resolution plans, and it also required them to deposit certain monies as earnest money. Interestingly, it fixed the last date for submission of expression of interest as October 2017. And another very interesting key point which was mentioned in this public notice was that the last date to submit the resolution plan was as per Regulation 38 of BCIRP regulations. Now, Regulation 38 of CIRP regulations provided that the last date for submission of resolution plan would be the 30 days prior to the end of total insolvency period, which is the total period of 180 days or 270 days as the case may be. So reading the Regulation 38 as it stood at that point in time, the last date was actually 150th day of the process or 240th day of the process. Liberty House clearly missed submitting its expression of interest on time. It got delayed by almost more than a month. While the expression of interest was acknowledged and it was received by the RP, the RP at that point in time told Liberty House or informed Liberty House to submit other documents to establish its eligibility, which Liberty House at that point in time failed to do. Now, during this period, Regulation 38, which got amended, this happened sometime in November, December, and this was amended now to say that the last date of submission of resolution plan would be the date fixed by the RP as with the approval of COC. So keeping this in mind, the resolution professional in this case then fixed the last date of submission of resolution plans. That date fixed by the resolution professional was sometime in January 2018. It was moved further to January 28, 2018, and then further moved to February 8, 2018. Liberty House again failed to submit the resolution plan on the last date, which was February 8, 2018. And while on February 8, 2018, which was the last date fixed by the RP, they opened the resolution plans of the bidders who submitted on time, and the news reports started floating up with respect to the amounts that were bidded in the bidding process. So what happened is when the committee considered the resolution plan which was submitted by the Liberty House, it actually took into consideration its delayed submission, and it held that because it was delayed submission, they refused to actually consider the plan. They in fact did not even open the plan. Liberty House challenged this view of the Committee of Creditors before the NCLT, and now we will look at how the NCLT has ordered. Now, in my opinion, in my personal opinion, I believe Liberty House has gotten away here on a technicality, because what the NCLT is doing now, it says that the public notice which was issued in September was issued under the old law, which referred to old Regulation 38 as it stood then, which meant that the last date was 150th day of submission of resolution plan. Now, because Liberty House has submitted this bid within that 150 days, it is well within the timelines to submit resolution plan. It also held that if the amended Regulation 38 was to apply on this process, a fresh public notice would have to be given out by the RP under the fresh regulations, and that is when the timelines fixed by the RP will become sacrosanct. So being the background of the case, it threw up some very interesting questions. And the first and foremost question that comes up to our mind is whether these amendments apply to ongoing processes of IRPs. So we of course understand that the code is going through teething problems and it is being amended time and again. But the clear issue here that comes forth is whether the amendments apply to ongoing processes. While some provisions which are inserted by amendments, they carry with themselves conditions under which they will in fact apply to ongoing processes. For example, Section 29A, Section 36A, Section 39, subsection 4, Regulation 39, sub-regulation 4, they all contain the conditions under which they will in fact apply to ongoing processes. However, largely there is absolutely no clarity on whether they will apply to, whether other amended provisions will apply to ongoing processes. This case seems to suggest that in order to apply the amended provisions to ongoing processes, the RPs will have to issue fresh notices. Now, if you look at the law, the general law which talks about the application of procedural law, under law it says that procedural law cannot be applied retrospectively if it creates any new disability, obligation, or duties with respect to the transactions. And this has been held time and again, upheld by the Supreme Court and various other courts. So, without going into detail much on the retrospective applicability of these amendments, this NCLT simply appeared to suggest that a fresh public notice was invited. We anticipate that there will be fresh litigation, and these issues like this will be likely to come up in forthcoming litigation. Now, another question, another very interesting question that threw up while this case was being argued before the court was with respect to withdrawal of bid. Both the resolution professional and the Committee of Creditors, their counsels argued before the tribunal that if they allowed the Liberty House to submit its late bid, Tata Steel, which is the appropriate bidder, which has submitted its plan within time, Tata Steel will withdraw its bid. Now, we see that in some process documents, and there are some, in some cases, agreements between resolution professionals and the resolution applicants, and they do provide for withdrawal of bid. But withdrawing of bid on such grounds or without even assigning any grounds, can that be allowed? In such a case, you know, any if withdrawal of bid is allowed, then or if withdrawal of bid is allowed at that or at that final stage, then any it may derail any CIRP process. The other issue that very interestingly came up was with respect to whether the resolution professional or the COC can move the timelines it has set or can move the timelines that are prescribed. So in recent case, what we saw is that resolution professional moved the last date of submission of plan twice. In fact, first in January and second again in January to February. It also in a way waived the requirement to submit expression of interest at a particular date by insinuating or accepting the expression of interest of Liberty House when it belatedly submitted the same. So again, in my personal opinion, I believe that there are softer deadlines and harder deadlines which are there. Harder deadlines are the timelines which have the force of law, which emerge from regulation. And softer deadlines are the deadlines which can be fixed or timelines which can be fixed by the resolution professional, so or this committee of creditors. So the softer deadlines can in fact be moved. However, it will be prejudicial if the harder deadlines are moved by the COC or RP. This view has also. It appears that this view has also been indulged in one of the other cases of Binani, where the NCLT has held that these softer deadlines, if it results in maximization of values, can in fact be moved. However, I'd like to put a caution over here, can be moved only if it is not prejudicial to interest of parties, and balance of interest has to be maintained in the processes. Another interesting issue that we saw come up in this.
Kamran, thanks a lot on this. And maybe before the next issue, I have one question for Karan. And yes, you touched upon this issue of withdrawal of bid. It looks very innocuous in terms of, I have given a bid, why can't I withdraw? Whether it is a threat to get something done or whether you are doing it legitimately under law, how does it matter? But there has been a huge jurisprudence on this issue vis-a-vis the law of tenders, where the courts have given a very clear mandate that what is an invitation to the bid, what is an offer submitted pursuant to an invitation to bid, and what is the acceptance. And this goes back to the very basic principles of Contract Act as to what is a binding offer, when it can be withdrawn before acceptance, and what is an acceptance, and the examples that we have read in the first year of law. So from that perspective, does this require any debate, Karan, or this is something which is going back to things which are already something which we know what and how to resolve it.
So, Vyapak, I think more than debate, it needs a little bit of articulation. You're probably absolutely right. The law of tenders was a basic principle that we agree. And if I submitted a bid in a tender or a bid process, that was merely still an offer. And till that bid wasn't really accepted by the person who was inviting bid, the contract was not completed, right? Therefore, rises this question, and when you look at it a bit, bidding in such a situation. And also remember, we're trying to bid in a situation where we can maximize the value that will be paid to A, debt holders, and B, of course, to other stakeholders, right? Now, in this situation, when you apply this concept to the facts, I think an important thing is, what should have the RP done, or what can RPs do to make sure that the offer is somewhat binding? And I think the natural point here that is again the law of contract, that if your contract provides otherwise, it is something where you can change the process. And therefore, the expression of interest that are issued must be very clear as to when can a bid be made, can that bid actually be topped or not be topped, and up to what time will they be accepted. And this is all within the time frame, within the broader contour that the law has laid out. We're not trying to change the timeline that the law has set. But for the process within it, I think it's very fair to have a sort of a construct that the expression of interest clearly lays out, and that all bidders should really follow. And
sure.
Probably learning, of course, as we go along.
Sure. Also, the other point, Kamran, you touched upon is the process or the mechanism, right? For the purpose of invitation of bids, for change in the timelines, for the purpose of evaluation of tenders. Again, there has been a lot of work which has already been done by the Association of Banks and some other intermediaries on this aspect. So is this again something which where we have to reinvent the wheel, or whether the Binani Cement case throws some light, or again this is an issue which is blown out of proportion? Arjun, do you have any view on this?
Sure. Thanks, Apple. So the Indian Banking Association in January of 2018 had released a circular which contained guidelines with respect to evaluation criteria and how lenders should go about with respect to choosing the successful resolution applicant from a pool of bidders. However, what we have seen through the judgment in the Binani case is that over there, all the bids were submitted well within the timeline prescribed in the notice issued by the resolution professional. But the entire question which arose, or the dispute over there, was post this. Post that, the COC actually met these prospective applicants and discussed their plans with them. And thereafter, they used the evaluation criteria which was provided to these applicants to choose one amongst them. And they chose Dalmia to be the H1 bidder, or the person who they would choose to go ahead in this process and carry out further negotiations. But while they were doing that, Ultratech had provided a revised bid. Now, the COC in that case did not consider this revised bid of Ultratech, citing the IBA guidelines and saying that now all our negotiations will solely be with the H1 bidder, which is Dalmia. The NCLT over here has said that that the process or the mechanism prescribed under the process documents is something which is formulated internally by the COC and does not hold statutory force. Therefore, if the RP and the COC are of the opinion that there is a revised bid or there is some change which is being proposed by an existing bidder, which would be beneficial for all stakeholders, then they should essentially modify this process and the mechanism to consider this better bid. And they should not stick to the process which has already been circulated with everybody. Now, obviously, that does fall in line and syncs up with the ultimate objective of maximization of the realization of assets for a company. But while doing this, we should also keep in mind that the ultimate objective is to complete the entire process within the period of 270 days, failing which you will mandatorily be sent for liquidation. And therefore, we'll have to harmonize the requirement to maximize proceeds vis-a-vis the requirement to keep the entire process within the envisaged timeline.
Sure. So with that, maybe Kamran, if you have any final views or any further comments on Bhushan's team, then maybe you can add. And post that, we will open the floor for questions, because I think there are quite a few listeners who have been patiently hearing us. I'm sure they have their views and comments which they may want to share. And of course, then we'll continue with the rest of the topics.
Sure. So I just would like to very quickly add another issue that was seen emerging out of this Bhushan Power judgment. and which was with respect to how do you assess the genuineness of a resolution applicant. Now, what happened in this case is that Liberty House did not give the disclosure undertaking till the very end, and it also did not provide its eligibility document till the very end. It did not deposit the earnest money. It did not take the access to virtual data room, and it did not conduct any site inspections. So keeping all of this in mind, the resolution professional and committee of creditors actually thought that this this applicant is not a very serious applicant in this case, and therefore also added to the disqualification. Now, whether should the RP or COC have the power to disqualify an applicant based on the conduct or seriousness is another question that we can take. But I think given the time constraints, we can open the floor to questions.
Yeah, sure. So maybe we'll open the floor for questions for time being. And depending upon how it goes, we'll also touch upon the other topics. Otherwise, as we have announced earlier, we have been doing this series. This is the third in the row, and we will be conducting the fourth in next couple of weeks, and we'll announce the date immediately after this webinar. So with that, maybe open the line for questions.
Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handset mode while asking your question. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, please press star and one at this time. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. A reminder to all our participants, if you wish to ask a question, you may press star and one.
Are there any questions? If not, I have one question based on this last topic with which you know Kamran touched upon. Is determining the seriousness of the bidder. Now, this is a very sensitive topic in sense somebody may not have given the bid in a timeline prescribed. Somebody may not have taken certain steps for varied reasons, and not in relation to that seriousness or otherwise. Is this even required? Is this something which needs to even go into so long as you know you are following the process and the timeline, which anyways has to be followed under the law? So Simon.
So Jacob, I think given the given how the bankruptcy law really works and its purpose, so I think right now we're just seeing the first phase of bankrupt companies. It should not be a situation that you know the resolution professional or the resolution applicant, after submitting the bid, 2 years down the line, is unable to revive the company for whatever reason, and you know the cycle continues because the law would have not really achieved its purpose. So having said that, I mean I think there is definitely a reason for having a serious bidder concept. And therefore, I don't disagree with, you know, with the COC looking at serious bidders versus not, and it's not necessarily just a number game in terms of, you know, who a serious bidder is. But having said that, a serious bidder may or may not be arrived at basis whether you deposited, made a deposit or given a deposit or not. It could be various other considerations, including how you run your, you know, other companies and the metal that you have to run a company that is currently undergoing the insolvency process. So while the seriousness of the bidder needs to be looked at, I don't think there are, you know, absolute objectives that necessarily determine whether or not you are a serious bidder.
Sure. So I think since we have still not heard about any other further questions, So maybe then we can, you know, close the telecon as of now. And while I think we have discussed some of the interesting objections and highly technical issues which have been raised to derail certain processes, to make certain bidders ineligible, technical objections on timeline, but all of that has in a way culminated into at least some results, and there is a silver lining to this. We have been seeing that a couple of matters are coming to close. Money is flowing in, at least the bankers are getting something out of it rather than just waiting. And in fact, the recent MCA report, the Ministry of Corporate Affairs, shows that the data indicates that more and more companies, more than 2,000 companies, are in fact voluntarily, you know, repaying the debts before it goes into NPAs, because there are stringent norms that the moment there is an insolvency process, they lose control, the promoters or the current management lose control on the affairs of the company. So with that good note, I think we'll continue this discussions next on June 14th. We will circulate the agenda and the discussion points shortly to the participants, and we'll be back as always. So thank you, and thanks for joining.
Thank you. On behalf of Nisha Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.